Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we'll speak with an analyst about the Syria ceasefire plan. Consider the future for Islamic State. There's an effort to resolve the privacy versus security issue in the digital era. And take a look at the best song and best original score Oscar nominees.
Music in movies is really important, and people really care about it. And so that's a really kind of beautiful and exciting thing to know.
It's right here on The Voice of America. The main Syrian opposition group, the Saudi-backed High Negotiations Committee, says it will observe a U.S.-Russian-backed cessation of hostilities for 2 weeks to test the commitment of its Russian-backed opponents. The HNC has welcomed the ceasefire, but spokesman Salam El-Meslet outlined his group's concerns.
We still have a few question marks here and there because the agreement did not really mention the HNC as a partner there. If you remember, the statement was made by President Obama and some of the officials in the American administration that the regime, Syrian regime, has lost legitimacy. But in this agreement, we see that they're giving this regime legitimacy. The problem here, you know, in this agreement, if they target al-Nusra, we're not defending al-Nusra. We're against, you know, al-Qaeda. We're against ISIS. But maybe they will use that as an excuse to target moderate fighters, to target the Syrian Free Army. And there has to be some assurance, you know, from the states, especially from the United States. I believe the responsibility now of the United States to protect civilians in Syria, to protect modern fighters.
The ceasefire, scheduled to go into effect at midnight Friday local time, does not cover militant groups like the Islamic State or the Al-Qaeda-linked Nusra Front. President Obama said he remains cautious about raising expectations a pause in the five-year war can be achieved.
If over the next several weeks we can see some lessening of the violence that's been racking that country, then that provides us a basis to build a longer-term ceasefire, both in the north and the south, and allows us to move forward on the political transition that ultimately is going to be necessary to bring an end to the civil war in Syria. It also would allow us then to focus all of our efforts, all the parties in the entire world community, including Russia, in going after ISIL, something that right now they are not doing and are not focused on.
Mr. Obama's caution is understandable, says Middle East Institute scholar Zubar Iqbal. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty there is no enforcement mechanism to the ceasefire.
Therefore, it's a question of the goodwill of the parties. The parties have not shown any goodwill so far. The only reason why there is some sort of a sense in this is that some parties are interested in prolonging, delaying the time when the hostilities have to end, during which time they will strengthen their position and therefore their negotiating stance as well. As I see it, this particular understanding is not very significant, not very important. Yes, we can wait for a week and see what happens. Yes. If during that week the forces which are supportive of the Assad government, particularly the Iranian and the other militias who are there, if they make significant headway, then yes, they will be starting from a position of strength, and then the Russians may be able to impose upon them the desire to negotiate because they're negotiating from a position of strength. However, Russia does not want to become bogged down in this operation for too long. The longer they get bogged down in it, the worse it gets for them. At the same time, it is in the interest of countries like Syria and Iran to get Russia involved as deeply as possible, because then it gives them the depth, the strategic depth that they need to be able to continue to do what they're doing. What it really boils down to is, don't hang your hat on this. It's not there to be hung. It's a very, very murky situation. Nothing has changed. This whole notion about humanitarian assistance is a big facade. It's not going to work out. The basic fundamentals have changed completely. And Syria is becoming uninhabitable and is losing its population at a very fast pace. It could very well be a situation where it will become totally underpopulated region.
What do you see as the future then?
There is no concrete basis at this moment to be able to say much. All I can hazard is that likelihood is that if the stalemate continues on the front of the Islamic State and the Kurds with Turkey, then things will get worse and we'll reach a stage where increasingly larger number of rebels will be leaving the moderate groups or those who are being supported by Saudi Arabia and moving towards the Islamic State, which would then mean that because Russians are really not interested in taking on the Islamic State, we, the allies, will have a much larger problem on our hands.
And Zubair Iqbal says he expects the fighting will continue even after the ceasefire begins, with Russian-backed Syrian forces growing stronger and gaining more ground, while the opposition is lacking resources and gets weaker. Time for a look at what's going on the web today concerning this story. And joining me with the details is my buddy, social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you very much. Always good to be with you. Well, there's a lot of anticipation on social media about the Syria potential ceasefire. It hasn't happened yet. People are questioning whether it will happen. So there's a lot of questions. There's a lot of anticipation on social media. But as it's implemented, if it's implemented, we're going to see a lot of reaction for sure. And we'll have that going into the weekend and into next week. Here in the U.S. today, what's trending is hashtag Witch Hillary. Now,
That doesn't sound like it's a very nice one.
No, it's not Witch Hillary like she's a witch or anything. It's, Witch Hillary is going to show up kind of thing. What happened was Hillary Clinton, who's running for president, was at a fundraiser in South Carolina. And a Black Lives Matter activist interrupted as a part of the Black Lives Matter movement. And people are using this as kind of a flashpoint and saying, Witch Hillary is going to show up? Is it one who's talked to the African-American community and tried to be an advocate? Or is it going to be another Hillary? A lot of people pointing to a video of her in, I think, 1996 when she was first lady, talking about incarceration and saying she has two different positions.
Yes, I saw that video of the exchange and it was rather heated.
Yeah, that in and of itself was something that was being shared across social media. So people saying which Hillary is going to show up, but then you have Hillary supporters saying which Hillary are they going to attack today? Is it going to be they're attacking her for this or they're attacking her for that? So really it's interesting how this hashtag started out as an attack against Hillary Clinton, and now it's being picked up by her supporters and they're trying to throw it back. But a heated back and forth on social media over that for sure.
There's been a lot of mudslinging in this political race.
There has, for sure. And it's
on all sides.
On all sides. In social media, once you get people together in the virtual world to kind of have these debates, there's a lot of mudslinging there as well, unfortunately. But there's also a lot of positive debate. We don't want to just focus on the negative. There is actual people sharing their positions, trying to influence others. So it can be a very powerful tool as well.
Okay. Well, thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
When thinking about the impact of air pollution on human health, respiratory and cardiovascular disease would probably be among the first to come to mind. A new study conducted by an international team of researchers is suggesting that laboratory rats who were exposed to the highly polluted air of Beijing for 3 to 8 weeks also gained weight, along with having cardiorespiratory problems. To reach their findings, the team put pregnant rats, along with their young, in two separate compartments. One was open to the outdoor air of Beijing, and the other included an air filter that removed most of the air pollution. Besides weight gain, the researchers also found that the air pollution-breathing rats also had higher levels of LDL, or bad cholesterol, triglycerides, and insulin resistance. Having a higher insulin resistance level often leads to type 2 diabetes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Islamic State is one of the forces that is fighting in Syria, and it has reached out across the region. To get an update on its status, we're speaking with Paul Salem, a Middle East Institute expert on the region. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
First of all, what is the current state of Islamic State?
The current state is that they are becoming more embattled in their main area of control in Iraq and Syria, although they've survived almost 2 years there, but they're coming increasingly under attack. They are branching out in a significant way in Libya, and that could be perhaps an area they relocate to in a major way if indeed they continue to suffer losses in Iraq and Syria. So I think they are approaching sort of a transition point. They are still powerful, they are still effective, but they are not on the ascendant in Iraq and Syria, although they are in Libya.
Does this mean that the allied forces coming after them and the other forces that have been bombing them have been successful to some degree?
It's a combination of dynamics. One is the international coalition, the air campaign, the blocking of finance, stopping of oil sales, blocking of movement of fighters. There's also been significant successes by the Iraqi army and federal police and people there, both in Tikrit and Ramadi, and they are now preparing for the liberation of Mosul, Iraq's second largest city. And in Syria, the Kurdish forces have been very effective in pushing ISIS back. ISIS is also at war with the Syrian regime and the Syrian rebels. So all of this combination of forces, in addition to the fact that the populations where ISIS is have, they have not risen up, but they have not been cooperative either.
Would you say that ISIS forces have not made themselves welcomed by residents of the areas in which they're fighting? They seem to be ruling by terror and fear and humiliation rather than getting the local people to support them.
Yeah, that has been consistently the case. Small minorities in these communities have supported them or joined them, often because, you know, there were very few options left to them. These were the powers that were there, and some people dealt with them. But there's no doubt in the areas that they've taken over, there's no real appetite, there's no support for this type of very gruesome, very radical rule. Now, at the same time, these populations have not risen up, but they have not been supportive, and they've often been very useful for outside powers in terms of information and intelligence.
Do you see the day when we'll be free of ISIS, or is this something that's going to be with us forever?
I see a day where we will be free of ISIS in some important patches of the world. I think they will be defeated in Iraq this year and possibly in Syria this year or the next. But I think as a mindset, as a global network, we will not be rid of it because it will survive in this or that ungoverned space around the world. I think, though, it will become more like Al-Qaeda, which is simply a network and ideology that unfortunately will live on, even if it does not succeed in securing a major base, you know, on the ground.
Well, thank you so much for your insight.
Thank you.
Coming up on International Edition, trying to break the privacy versus security social media stalemate. And who's up for a musical Oscar? Leaders of two key U.S. congressional committees involved in national security joined together Wednesday to propose the creation of a national commission to explore the often conflicting issues of privacy and security in the digital era. International Edition's Doug Bernard covers social media and joins us now here in the studio. Welcome, Doug.
Hi, Susan.
What can you tell us about this commission?
Well, it's a proposed commission at this point. It's being introduced by Representative Michael McCaul, who is the chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, and Senator Mark Warner, who is a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Representative McCaul is a Republican. Senator Warner is a Democrat. Representative McCaul comes from a law enforcement background. Senator Warner, of course, very famously made millions of dollars in the tech industry. So they're really kind of bringing together, I think, a number of elements and kind of competing views. And the idea is that this commission, on which 16 people will sit, some elected officials, some tech leaders, other academics, that sort of thing, is to try and find a way out of what seems to be this trap that we have fallen into, in which privacy concerns are set against security concerns, as if people had to choose one or the other. I think both of them are trying to find a way to say, let's find a different way to think about these very important issues in our new digital era.
Well, coming as it is right now, it seems like it's in response to that current legal standoff we've been seeing between Apple and the FBI.
Right. It does seem that, but this really has been in the works for months. Representative McCowell has been talking about this. This bill is really, we've been waiting for this for probably about 6 months now. And they're very quick to point out this is not a commission on encryption, which is really the key issue at stake in that Apple FBI legal standoff. But of course, encryption is part of that. And it's that battle that we're seeing play out between Silicon Valley and the government is in many ways indicative of the larger debates and discussions and tensions, really, that these digital technologies present in the real world.
Both sides in the privacy versus security debate seem to be digging in the heels.
Right.
They're not easily changing their opinions.
Right.
What is the likelihood this commission can break that up?
Well, you know, they're modeling it after the 9/11 commission, which really was actually fairly successful. They came out with a series of proposals. Many of them, I think, would have been very difficult for Congress to take up and pass, but they were. They were addressed and they were passed. And I think what the commission ideally it seems to be inclining to is finding a different frame for the discussion. We often use this privacy versus security. Many, many people do. Well, one analyst I spoke with said, you know, that's really kind of a broad brush, and it doesn't seem to be accomplishing anything. Maybe what we need to do is find a different frame to put around all these various issues to get about the business of finding agreement and doing all the things that we need to protect ourselves, our individual privacy, but also, you know, our nation and our, you know, national security.
You've written a story about this. It's on our web.
It certainly is.
Okay, that's at voanews.com if you want some more information on it. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? It's the world's first touch-free smartphone. Made by a company called Sesame Enable, based in Jerusalem, the phone is designed for people with disabilities who can't use their hands. Used with a Sesame controller and an Android app, it detects the user's head movements. Your head controls the cursor. The user just says, "Open Sesame," and the phone lights up. Company founder, Oded Ben-Dov.
If you envision a person who is completely paralyzed, sitting at home all day long, for him it's that window outside to the world. Can connect to family and friends, he can watch YouTube, he can do so much more. And that's why we call it Open Sesame. It opens up worlds for them.
Haggett Ringler has multiple sclerosis. She used her phone only to answer calls until she got the Sesame smartphone.
Beyond that, I hardly used the phone, and now I can use everything.
Sesame Enable says as long as someone can move their head, they can learn how to use this device. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossons.
The Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts, and Sciences awards its Oscars in Hollywood Sunday. The Best Song and Best Original Score Oscars are among those being handed out. International Edition's David Byrd has this look at the nominees.
The song that plays in Michael Caine's head as he portrays an aging orchestra conductor in Youth is up for the Academy Award for Best Song. Composer David Lang has never written for film before, but says his experience has taught him the vital role that music plays in movies.
Most of all, the thing that I'm excited about, which I guess I sort of knew, but I didn't really know, now I sort of feel, is that music in movies is really important and people really care about it. And so that's a really kind of beautiful and exciting thing to know.
Eight-time Oscar nominee Diane Warren is up for her song with co-writer Lady Gaga, "Till It Happens to You" from The Hunting Ground, an expose of rape crimes on U.S. college campuses, their institutional cover-ups, and the devastating toll that they take on students and their families. Warren says she was more excited about this nomination than her others because of the subject matter.
Look, it's always great to be nominated. It really is. I mean, think of how many songs are out a year. You know, hundreds, thousands in movies. And the fact that someone picked this song, it's amazing.
For you, I have to
Multiple Grammy winner Sam Smith and Jimmy Napes teamed up for Writings on the Wall from the James Bond film Spectre. Smith says that he wanted to do something different from the previous Bond themes.
That's what I felt made it different to the other Bond songs that feel classic in that way. I wanted to inject a bit of our lyric and the way that we write songs, which is so vulnerable. And I think for Bond, that's very strange to do that. So that's what I wanted to do.
All the loving and separating.
Also up for Best Song is Manta Ray from the documentary Racing Extinction. Composer Jay Ralph says he had a very special reason for writing the song the way he did.
During the making of the documentary, the filmmakers invited me up to the Cornell Bioacoustic Laboratory, and they played me a recording of a male OO bird singing his mating call. Unbeknownst to him, he was the last of his species, so the mating call would never be answered. So I wanted the score to be a melody response to his little song.
Carter Burwell is up for Best Original Score for Carol, in which Rooney Mara portrays an aspiring photographer who develops a romantic relationship with an older woman, played by Oscar winner Cate Blanchett. Burwell says because the film has sparse dialogue, the music plays a huge role.
But in a lot of other areas, it was about, let's not say this yet, let's hold back a little bit of melody, let's make it a suspense film.
The 88th Annual Academy Awards ceremony is Sunday at the Dolby Theater in Los Angeles. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a recent speech at Stanford University, Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor Tom Malinowski spoke of an age-old contest, the struggle between the desire of people to be free, to be treated with dignity, and to have control over their own lives, and the fundamentally authoritarian impulse that believes ordinary men and women are too small-minded to govern their own affairs, the impulse that fuels the dictator's desire to seize and cling to power. Today, the latter impulse, said Assistant Secretary Malinowski, is seen in its most extreme manifestation in ISIL, where terrorists seek to use the veneer of religious legitimacy to justify a thirst for control that includes the desire to kill, rape, and subjugate. But there are other places that reflect the authoritarian urge. Bashar al-Assad's Syria, with its brutal reaction to the aspirations of the Arab Spring. Vladimir Putin's Russia, where human rights organizations are now being vilified as traitors. China, where the government is lashing out at dissidents at home and kidnapping them abroad. But the ardent desire for people to control their own lives is also having its successes, said Mr. Malinowski. In Burma, where the people were able to cast their ballots for elected lawmakers for the first time in decades. In Sri Lanka, where the two communities that had long divided the country, the Sinhalese and Tamils, came together in an election to oust an authoritarian government. The United States, with its own ideals of democracy and the rule of law, has a great stake in the battle that is being waged. So it makes great sense, Mr. Malinowski said, that we defend people around the world who are trying peacefully to advance respect for human rights before conflict between power and people leads to devastating consequences. That we speak out when governments try to stifle dissent or control the internet or pollute their citizens' efforts and aspirations with corruption. Our hopes for the world may not be fully realized, said Assistant Secretary Malinowski, but the world is not falling apart. It is presenting a challenge to which we must rise. And if we keep doing so, I believe things will get better, slowly but surely.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.